contrary. She pinched her lips together. "If they wished, I would," she said. "I wouldn't." "Who wishes you would?" "The servants, and of course Dr. Craven, because he would get Misselthwaite and be rich instead of poor. He daren't say so, but he always looks cheerful when I am worse. When I had typhoid fever, his face got quite fat. I think my father wishes it too." "I don't believe he does," said Mary quite obstinately. That made Colin turn and look at her again. "Don't you?" he said. And then he lay back on his cushion and was still, as if he were thinking. And there was quite a long silence. Perhaps they were both of them thinking strange things children do not usually think of. "I like the Grand Doctor from London, because he made them take the iron thing off," said Mary at last. "Did he say you were going to die?"
"No."
"What did he say?" "He didn't whisper," Colin answered. "Perhaps he knew I hated whispering. I heard him say one thing quite aloud. He said the lad might live if he would make up his mind to it. Put him in the humour. It sounded as if he was in a temper." "I'll tell you who would put you in the humour, perhaps," said Mary, reflecting. She felt as if she would like this thing to be settled one way or the other. "I believe Dickon would. He's always talking about live things. He never talks about dead things or things that are ill. He's always looking up in the sky to watch birds flying, or looking down at the earth to see something growing. He has such round blue eyes, and they are so wide open with looking about. And he laughs such a big laugh with his wide mouth, and his cheeks are as red as cherries." She pulled her stool nearer to the sofa, and her expression quite changed at the remembrance of the wide, curving mouth and wide open eyes. "See here," she said, "don't let us talk about dying. I don't like it. Let us talk about living. Let us talk and talk about Dickon, and then we will look at your pictures." It was the best thing she could have said. To talk about Dickon meant to talk about the moor and about the cottage and the 14 people who lived in it on 16 shillings a week and the children who got fat on the moor grass like the wild ponies and about Dickon's mother and the skipping rope and the moor with the sun on it and about pale green points sticking up out of the black sod. And it was all so alive that Mary talked more than she'd ever talked before. And Colin both talked and listened as he had never done either before. And they both began to laugh over nothings, as children will when they are happy together. And they laughed so that in the end they were making as much noise as if they had been two ordinary, healthy, natural 10-year-old creatures, instead of a hard little unloving girl and a sickly boy who believed that he was going to die. They enjoyed themselves so much that they forgot the pictures and they forgot about the time. They had been laughing quite loudly over Ben Weatherstaff and his robin, and Colin was actually sitting up, as if he had forgotten about his weak back, when he suddenly remembered something. "Do you know there is one thing we have never once thought of?" he said. "We are cousins." It seemed so queer that they had talked so much and never remembered this simple thing, that they laughed more than ever, because they had got into the humour to laugh at anything. And in the midst of the fun, the door opened, and in walked Dr. Craven and Mrs. Medlock. Dr. Craven started in actual alarm, and Mrs. Medlock almost fell back because he had accidentally bumped against her. "Good Lord!" exclaimed poor Mrs. Medlock, with her eyes almost starting out of her head. "Good Lord!"
"What is this?" said Dr. Craven, coming forward. "What does it mean?"
Then Mary was reminded of the boy Raja again. Colin answered as if neither the doctor's alarm nor Mrs. Medlock's terror were of the slightest consequence. He was as little disturbed or frightened as if an elderly cat and dog had walked into the room. "This is my cousin, Mary Lennox," he said. "I asked her to come and talk to me. I like her. She must come and talk to me whenever I send for her." Dr. Craven turned reproachfully to Mrs. Medlock.
"Oh, sir," she panted, "I don't know how it's happened. There's not a servant on the place that'd dare to talk, and they all have their orders." "Nobody told her anything," said Colin. "She heard me crying and found me herself. I am glad she came. Don't be silly, Medlock."
Mary saw that Dr. Craven did not look pleased, but it was quite plain that he dare not oppose his patient. He sat down by Colin and felt his pulse.
"I am afraid there has been too much excitement. Excitement is not good for you, my boy," he said.
"I should be excited if she kept away," answered Colin, his eyes beginning to look dangerously sparkling. "I am better. She makes me better. The nurse must bring up her tea with mine. We will have tea together."
Mrs. Medlock and Dr. Craven looked at each other in a troubled way, but there was evidently nothing to be done.
"He does look rather better, sir," ventured Mrs. Medlock.
But, thinking the matter over,
"He looked better this morning, before she came into the room."
"She came into the room last night. She stayed with me a long time. She sang a Hindustani song to me and it made me go to sleep," said Colin. "I was better when I wakened up."
"I wanted my breakfast. I want my tea now. Tell nurse, Medlock."
Dr. Craven did not stay very long. He talked to the nurse for a few minutes when she came into the room and said a few words of warning to Colin. He must not talk too much. He must not forget that he was ill. He must not forget that he was very easily tired. Mary thought that there seemed to be a number of uncomfortable things he was not to forget. Colin looked fretful and kept his strange black-lashed eyes fixed on Dr. Craven's face.
"I want to forget it," he said at last. "She makes me forget it. That is why I want her."
Dr. Craven did not look happy when he left the room. He gave a puzzled glance at the little girl sitting on the large stool. She had become a stiff, silent child again as soon as he entered, and he could not see what the attraction was. The boy actually did look brighter, however, and he sighed rather heavily as he went down the corridor.
"They are always wanting me to eat things when I don't want to," said Colin as the nurse brought in the tea and put it on the table by the sofa. "Now, if you'll eat, I will. Those muffins look so nice and hot. Tell me about Rajas."
Chapter 15. Nest Building. After another week of rain, the high arch of blue sky appeared again, and the sun which poured down was quite hot. Though there had been no chance to see either the secret garden or Dickon, Mistress Mary had enjoyed herself very much. The week had not seemed long. She had spent hours of every day with Colin in his room, talking about Rajas or gardens or Dickon and the cottage on the moor. They had looked at the splendid books and pictures, and sometimes Mary had read things to Colin, and sometimes he had read a little to her. When he was amused and interested, she thought he scarcely looked like an invalid at all, except that his face was so colourless and he was always on the sofa.
"You were a sly young one to listen and get out of your bed to go following things up like you did that night," Mrs. Medlock said once. "But there's no saying it's not been a sort of blessing to the lot of us. He's not had a tantrum or a whining fit since you made friends. The nurse was just going to give up the case because she was so sick of him, but she says she doesn't mind staying now you've gone on duty with her," laughing a little.
In her talks with Colin, Mary had tried to be very cautious about the secret garden. There were certain things she wanted to find out from him, but she felt that she must find them out without asking him direct questions. In the first place, as she began to like to be with him, she wanted to discover whether he was the kind of boy you could tell a secret to. He was not in the least like Dickon, but he was evidently so pleased with the idea of a garden no one knew anything about that she thought perhaps he could be trusted. But she had not known him long enough to be sure. The second thing she wanted to find out was this. If he could be trusted, if he really could, wouldn't it be possible to take him to the garden without having anyone find it out? The grand doctor had said that he must have fresh air, and Colin had said that he would not mind fresh air in a secret garden. Perhaps if he had a great deal of fresh air, and knew Dickon and the robin, and saw things growing, he might not think so much about dying. Mary had seen herself in the glass sometimes lately, when she had realized that she looked quite a different creature from the child she had seen when she arrived from India. This child looked nicer. Even Martha had seen a change in her. "The air from the moor has done thee good already," she had said. "Thou'rt not nice a yeller, and thou'rt not nice a scrawny. Even the hair doesn't slamp down on the head so flat. It's got some life in it, so as it sticks out a bit."
"It's like me," said Mary. "It's growing stronger and fatter. I'm sure there's more of it."
"It looks it for sure," said Martha, ruffling it up a little round her face. "Thou'rt not half so ugly when it's that way, and there's a bit of red in thy cheeks."
If gardens and fresh air had been good for her, perhaps they would be good for Colin. But then if he hated people to look at him, perhaps he would not like to see Dickon. "Why does it make you angry when you are looked at?" she inquired one day. "I always hated it," he answered, "even when I was very little. Then when they took me to the seaside, and I used to lie in my carriage, everybody used to stare, and ladies would stop and talk to my nurse, and then they would begin to whisper, and I knew then they were saying I shouldn't live to grow up. Then sometimes the ladies would pat my cheeks and say, 'Poor child.' Once when a lady did that, I screamed out loud and bit her hand. She was so frightened she ran away."
"She thought you had gone mad like a dog," said Mary, not at all admiringly.
"I don't care what she thought," said Colin, frowning.
"I wonder why you didn't scream and bite me when I came into your room," said Mary. Then she began to smile slowly.
"I thought you were a ghost or a dream," he said. "You can't bite a ghost or a dream, and if you scream, they don't care."
"Would you hate it if a boy looked at you?" Mary asked uncertainly.
He lay back on his cushion and paused thoughtfully.
"There's one boy," he said quite slowly, as if he were thinking over every word. "There's one boy I believe I shouldn't mind. It's that boy who knows where the foxes live, Dickon."
"I'm sure you wouldn't mind him," said Mary.
"The birds don't, and other animals," he said, still thinking it over. "Perhaps that's why I shouldn't. He's a sort of animal charmer, and I am a boy animal."
Then he laughed, and she laughed too. In fact, it ended in their both laughing a great deal, and finding the idea of a boy animal hiding in his hole very funny indeed. What Mary felt afterward was that she need not fear about Dickon. On that first morning, when the sky was blue again, Mary wakened very early. The sun was pouring in slanted rays through the blinds, and there was something so joyous in the sight of it that she jumped out of bed and ran to the window. She drew up the blinds and opened the window itself, and a great waft of fresh scented air blew in upon her. The moor was blue, and the whole world looked as if something magic had happened to it. There were tender little fluting sounds here and there and everywhere, as if scores of birds were beginning to tune up for a concert. Mary put her hand out of the window and held it in the sun.
"It's warm, warm," she said.
"It will make the green points push up and up and up, and it will make the bulbs and roots work and struggle with all their might under the earth." She kneeled down and leaned out of the window as far as she could, breathing big breaths and sniffing the air, until she laughed because she remembered what Dickon's mother had said about the end of his nose quivering like a rabbit's.
"It must be very early," she said. "The little clouds are all pink, and I've never seen the sky look like this. No one is up. I don't even hear the stable boys."
A sudden thought made her scramble to her feet.
"I can't wait. I'm going to see the garden."
She had learned to dress herself by this time, and she put on her clothes in 5 minutes.
She knew a small side door which she could unbolt herself, and she flew downstairs in her stocking feet and put on her shoes in the hall. She unchained and unbolted and unlocked, and when the door was open, she sprang across the step with one bound, and there she was, standing on the grass, which seemed to have turned green, and with the sun pouring down on her, and warm, sweet wafts about her, and the fluting and twittering and singing coming from every bush and tree. She clasped her hands for pure joy and looked up in the sky, and it was so blue and pink and pearly and white and flooded with springtime light that she felt as if she must flute and sing aloud herself, and knew that thrushes and robins and skylarks could not possibly help it. She ran around the shrubs and paths toward the secret garden. "It is all different already," she said. "The grass is greener, and things are sticking up everywhere, and things are uncurling, and green buds of leaves are showing. This afternoon I am sure Dickon will come." The long warm rain had done strange things to the herbaceous beds which bordered the walk by the lower wall. There were things sprouting and pushing out from the roots of clumps of plants, and there were actually here and there glimpses of royal purple and yellow unfurling among the stems of crocuses. 6 months before, Mistress Mary would not have seen how the world was waking up, but now she missed nothing. When she had reached the place where the door hid itself under the ivy, she was startled by a curious loud sound. It was the caw, caw of a crow, and it came from the top of the wall, and when she looked up, there sat a big, glossy-plumaged, blue-black bird, looking down at her very wisely indeed. She had never seen a crow so close before, and he made her a little nervous, but the next moment he spread his wings and flapped away across the garden. She hoped he was not going to stay inside, and she pushed the door open, wondering if he would. When she got fairly into the garden, she saw that he probably did intend to stay, because he had alighted on a dwarf apple tree, and under the apple tree was lying a little reddish animal with a bushy tail, and both of them were watching the stooping body and rust-red head of Dickon, who was kneeling on the grass working hard. Mary flew across the grass to him. "Oh, Dickon! Dickon!" she cried out. "How could you get here so early? How could you? The sun has only just got up." He got up himself, laughing and glowing, and tousled, his eyes like a bit of the sky. "Eh," he said, "I was up long before him. How could I have stayed abed? The world's all fair begun again this morning, it has. And it's working and humming and scratching and piping and nest-building and breathing out scents till you've got to be out on it, instead of lying on your back. When the sun did jump up, the moor went mad for joy, and I was in the midst of the heather, and I run like mad myself, shouting and singing. And I come straight here. I couldn't have stayed away. Why, the garden was lying here waiting." Mary put her hands on her chest, panting, as if she had been running herself. "Oh, Dickon, Dickon," she said. "I'm so happy I can scarcely breathe." Seeing him talking to a stranger, the little bushy-tailed animal rose from its place under the tree and came to him, and the rook, cawing once, flew down from its branch and settled quietly on his shoulder. "This is the little fox cub," he said, rubbing the little reddish animal's head. "It's named Captain, and this here's Soot. Soot, he flew across the moor with me, and Captain, he run same as if the hounds had been after him. They both felt same as I did." Neither of the creatures looked as if he were the least afraid of Mary. When Dickon began to walk about, Soot stayed on his shoulder and Captain trotted quietly close to his side. "See here," said Dickon. "See how these has pushed up, and these, and these. And, eh, look at these here." He threw himself upon his knees, and Mary went down beside him. They had come upon a whole clump of crocuses burst into purple and orange and gold. Mary bent her face down and kissed them. "You never kiss a person in that way," she said when she lifted her head. Flowers are so different. He looked puzzled but smiled. Eh, he said. I've kissed Mother many a time that way when I come in from the moor after a day's roaming, and she stood there at the door in the sun, looking so glad and comfortable. They ran from one part of the garden to another, and found so many wonders that they were obliged to remind themselves that they must whisper or speak low. He showed her swelling leaf buds on rose branches which had seemed dead. He showed her 10,000 new green points pushing through the mould. They put their eager young noses close to the earth and sniffed its warmed springtime breathing. They dug and pulled and laughed low with rapture until Mistress Mary's hair was as tumbled as Dickens and her cheeks were almost as poppy red as his. There was every joy on earth in the secret garden that morning, and in the midst of them came a delight more delightful than all because it was more wonderful. Swiftly something flew across the wall and darted through the trees to a close-grown corner, a little flare of red-breasted bird, with something hanging from its beak. Dickens stood quite still and put his hand on Mary almost as if they had suddenly found themselves laughing in a church. "We munnot stir," he whispered in broad Yorkshire. "We munnot scarce breathe. I knowed he was mate hunting when I seed him last. It's Ben Weatherstaff's robin. He's building his nest. He'll stay here if us don't fly at him." They settled down softly upon the grass and sat there without moving. "Us mustn't seem as if us was watching him too close," said Dickon. "He'd be out with us for good if he got the notion us was interfering now. He'll be a good bit different till all this is over. He's setting up housekeeping. He'll be shyer and readier to take things ill. He's got no time for visiting and gossiping. Us must keep still a bit and try to look as if us was grass and trees and bushes. Then when he's got used to seeing us, I'll chirp a bit, and he'll know us'll not be in his way." Mistress Mary was not at all sure that she knew, as Dickon seemed to, how to try to look like grass and trees and bushes. But he had said the queer thing as if it were the simplest and most natural thing in the world, and she felt it must be quite easy to him, and indeed she watched him for a few minutes carefully, wondering if it was possible for him to quietly turn green and put out branches and leaves. But he only sat wonderfully still, and when he spoke, dropped his voice to such a softness that it was curious that she could hear him, but she could. "It's part of the springtime, this nest building is," he said. "I warrant it's been going on in the same way every year since the world was begun. They've got their way of thinking and doing things, and a body had better not meddle. You can lose a friend in springtime easier than any other season if you're too curious."
"If we talk about him, I can't help looking at him," Mary said as softly as possible. "We must talk of something else. There is something I want to tell you."
"He'll like it better if us talks of something else," said Dickon. "What is it thou's got to tell me?"
"Well, do you know about Colin?" she whispered.
He turned his head to look at her.
"What does thou know about him?" he asked.
"I've seen him. I have been to talk to him every day this week. He wants me to come. He says I'm making him forget about being ill and dying," answered Mary.
Dickon looked actually relieved as soon as the surprise died away from his round face.
"I am glad of that," he exclaimed. "I'm right down glad. It makes me easier. I knowed I must say nothing about him, and I don't like having to hide things."
"Don't you like hiding the garden?" said Mary.
"I'll never tell about it," he answered. "But I says to Mother, 'Mother,' I says, 'I got a secret to keep. It's not a bad un, tha knows that. It's no worse than hiding where a bird's nest is. Tha doesn't mind it, does tha?'"
Mary always wanted to hear about Mother.
"What did she say?" she asked, not at all afraid to hear.
Dickon grinned sweet-temperedly.
"It was just like her, what she said," he answered. "She give my head a bit of a rub and laughed, and she says, 'Hey, lad, tha can have all the secrets tha like. I've knowed thee 12 year.'"
"How did you know about Colin?" asked Mary.
Everybody as knowed about Mr. Craven knowed there was a little lad as was like to be a cripple, and they knowed Mr. Craven didn't like him to be talked about. Folks is sorry for Mr. Craven because Mrs. Craven was such a pretty young lady, and they were so fond of each other. Mrs. Medlock stops in our cottage whenever she goes to Thwaite, and she doesn't mind talking to Mother before us children, because she knows us has been brought up to be trusty. How did tha find out about him? Martha was in fine trouble the last time she came home. She said tha'd heard him fretting, and tha was asking questions, and she didn't know what to say. Mary told him her story about the midnight wuthering of the wind which had wakened her, and about the faint far-off sounds of the complaining voice which had led her down the dark corridors with her candle, and had ended with her opening of the door of the dimly lighted room with the carven four-posted bed in the corner. When she described the small ivory-white face and the strange black-rimmed eyes, Dickon shook his head. "Them's just like his mother's eyes, only hers was always laughing, they say," he said. "They say as Mr. Craven can't bear to see him when he's awake, and it's because his eyes is so like his mother's and yet looks so different in his miserable bit of a face."
"Do you think he wants to die?"
whispered Mary. "No, but he wishes he'd never been born. Mother says that's the worst thing on earth for a child. Them as is not wanted scarce ever thrives. Mr. Craven, he'd buy anything as money could buy for the poor lad, but he'd like to forget as he's on earth. For one thing, he's afraid he'll look at him some day and find he's growed hunchback."
"Colin's so afraid of it himself that he won't sit up," said Mary. "He says he's always thinking that if he should feel a lump coming he should go crazy and scream himself to death."
"Eh, he oughtn't to lie there thinking things like that," said Dickon. "No lad could get well as thought them sort of things."
The fox was lying on the grass close by him, looking up to ask for a pat now and then, and Dickon bent down and rubbed his neck softly and thought a few minutes in silence. Presently he lifted his head and looked round the garden.
"When first we got in here," he said, "it seemed like everything was grey. Look round now, and tell me if tha doesn't see a difference."
Mary looked and caught her breath a little.
"Why," she cried, "the grey wall is changing. It is as if a green mist were creeping over it. It's almost like a green gauze veil."
"Aye," said Dickon, "and it'll be greener and greener till the grey's all gone."
"Can tha guess what I was thinking?"
"I know it was something nice," said Mary eagerly. "I believe it was something about Colin."
"I was just thinking that if he was out here he wouldn't be watching for lumps to grow on his back. He'd be watching for buds to break on the rose bushes, and he'd likely be healthier," explained Dickon.
"I was wondering if us could ever get him in the humour to come out here and lie under the trees in his carriage."
"I've been wondering that myself. I've thought of it almost every time I've talked to him," said Mary. "I've wondered if he could keep a secret, and I've wondered if we could bring him here without anyone seeing us. I thought perhaps you could push his carriage. The doctor said he must have fresh air, and if he wants us to take him out, no one dare disobey him. He won't go out for other people, and perhaps they will be glad if he will go out with us. He could order the gardeners to keep away so they wouldn't find out."
Dickon was thinking very hard as he scratched Captain's back. "It'd be good for him, I'll warrant," he said. "Us 'ud not be thinking he'd better never been born. Us 'ud be just two children watching a garden grow, and he'd be another. Two lads and a little lass just looking on at the springtime. I warrant it'd be better than doctor's stuff."
"He's been lying in his room so long, and he's always been so afraid of his back that it has made him queer," said Mary. "He knows a good many things out of books, but he doesn't know anything else. He says he has been too ill to notice things, and he hates going out of doors and hates gardens and gardeners. But he likes to hear about this garden because it is a secret. I daren't tell him much, but he said he wanted to see it."
"Us'll have him out here some time for sure," said Dickon. "I could push his carriage well enough. Has tha noticed how the robin and his mate has been working while we've been sitting here? Look at him perched on that branch, wondering where it'd be best to put that twig he's got in his beak." He made one of his low whistling calls, and the robin turned his head and looked at him inquiringly, still holding his twig. Dickens spoke to him as Ben Weatherstaff did, but Dickens' tone was one of friendly advice.
"Where's ever thou puts it," he said, "it'll be all right. Tha knew how to build thy nest before tha came out of the egg. Get on with thee, lad. Tha's got no time to lose."
"Oh, I do like to hear you talk to him," Mary said, laughing delightedly. "Ben Weatherstaff scolds him and makes fun of him, and he hops about and looks as if he understood every word, and I know he likes it. Ben Weatherstaff says he is so conceited he would rather have stones thrown at him than not be noticed."
Dickon laughed too, and went on talking. "Tha knows us won't trouble thee," he said to the robin. "Us is near being wild things ourselves. Us is nest-building too, bless thee. Look out tha doesn't tell on us."
And though the robin did not answer because his beak was occupied, Mary knew that when he flew away with his twig to his own corner of the garden, the darkness of his dew-bright eye meant that he would not tell their secret for the world. Chapter 16. "I won't," said Mary. They found a great deal to do that morning, and Mary was late in returning to the house, and was also in such a hurry to get back to her work that she quite forgot Colin until the last moment. "Tell Colin that I can't come and see him yet," she said to Martha. "I'm very busy in the garden." Martha looked rather frightened.
"Eh, Miss Mary," she said, "it may put him all out of humour when I tell him that."
But Mary was not as afraid of him as other people were, and she was not a self-sacrificing person. "I can't stay," she answered. "Dickon's waiting for me," and she ran away. The afternoon was even lovelier and busier than the morning had been. Already nearly all the weeds were cleared out of the garden, and most of the roses and trees had been pruned or dug about. Dickon had brought a spade of his own, and he had taught Mary to use all her tools, so that by this time it was plain that though the lovely wild place was not likely to become a gardener's garden, it would be a wilderness of growing things before the springtime was over. "There'll be apple blossoms and cherry blossoms overhead," Dickon said, working away with all his might. "And there'll be peach and plum trees in bloom against the walls, and the grass'll be a carpet of flowers." The little fox and the rook were as happy and busy as they were, and the robin and his mate flew backward and forward like tiny streaks of lightning. Sometimes the rook flapped his black wings and soared away over the treetops in the park. Each time he came back and perched near Dickon, and cawed several times as if he were relating his adventures, and Dickon talked to him just as he had talked to the robin. Once, when Dickon was so busy that he did not answer him at first, Soot flew onto his shoulders and gently tweaked his ear with his large beak. When Mary wanted to rest a little, Dickon sat down with her under a tree, and once he took a pipe out of his pocket and played the soft, strange little notes, and two squirrels appeared on the wall and looked and listened.
"Tha's a good bit stronger than thou was," Dickon said, looking at her as she was digging. "Tha's beginning to look different, for sure."
Mary was glowing with exercise and good spirits.
"I'm getting fatter and fatter every day," she said quite exultantly. "Mrs. Medlock will have to get me some bigger dresses. Martha says my hair is growing thicker. It isn't so flat and stringy."
The sun was beginning to set and sending deep gold-coloured rays slanting under the trees when they parted.
"It'll be fine tomorrow," said Dickon. "I'll be at work by sunrise."
"So will I," said Mary.
She ran back to the house as quickly as her feet would carry her. She wanted to tell Colin about Dickon's fox cub and the rook, and about what the springtime had been doing. She felt sure he would like to hear. So it was not very pleasant when she opened the door of her room to see Martha standing waiting for her with a doleful face.
"What is the matter?" she asked. "What did Colin say when you told him I couldn't come?"
"Eh," said Martha, "I wish tha'd gone. He was nigh going into one of his tantrums. There's been a nice to-do all afternoon to keep him quiet. He would watch the clock all the time."
Mary's lips pinched themselves together.
She was no more used to considering other people than Colin was, and she saw no reason why an ill-tempered boy should interfere with the thing she liked best. She knew nothing about the pitifulness of people who had been ill and nervous, and who did not know that they could control their tempers and need not make other people ill and nervous too. When she had had a headache in India, she had done her best to see that everybody else also had a headache or something quite as bad, and she felt she was quite right. But of course now she felt that Colin was quite wrong. He was not on his sofa when she went into his room. He was lying flat on his back in bed, and he did not turn his head toward her as she came in. This was a bad beginning, and Mary marched up to him with her stiff manner. "Why didn't you get up?" she said. "I did get up this morning when I thought you were coming," he answered, without looking at her. "I made them put me back in bed this afternoon. My back ached and my head ached and I was tired. Why didn't you come?" "I was working in the garden with Dickon," said Mary. Colin frowned and condescended to look at her. "I won't let that boy come here if you go and stay with him instead of coming to talk to me," he said. Mary flew into a fine passion. She could fly into a passion without making a noise. She just grew sour and obstinate and did not care what happened. "If you send Dickon away, I'll never come into this room again," she retorted. "You'll have to if I want you," said Colin. "I won't," said Mary. "I'll make you," said Colin. "They shall drag you in." "Shall they, Mr. Raja?" said Mary fiercely. "They may drag me in, but they can't make me talk when they get me here. I'll sit and clench my teeth and never tell you one thing. I won't even look at you. I'll stare at the floor." They were a nice, agreeable pair as they glared at each other. If they had been two little street boys, they would have sprung at each other and had a rough-and-tumble fight. As it was, they did the next thing to it. "You are a selfish thing," cried Colin. "What are you?" said Mary. "Selfish people always say that. Anyone is selfish who doesn't do what they want." "You're more selfish than I am. You're the most selfish boy I ever saw." "I'm not," snapped Colin. "I'm not as selfish as your fine Dickon is. He keeps you playing in the dirt when he knows I am all by myself. He's selfish, if you like." Mary's eyes flashed fire. "He's nicer than any other boy that ever lived," she said. He's like an angel." It might sound rather silly to say that, but she did not care. "A nice angel," Colin sneered ferociously. "He's a common cottage boy off the moor." "He's better than a common Raja," retorted Mary. "He's 1,000 times better." Because she was the stronger of the two, she was beginning to get the better of him. The truth was that he had never had a fight with anyone like himself in his life, and upon the whole it was rather good for him, though neither he nor Mary knew anything about that. He turned his head on his pillow and shut his eyes, and a big tear was squeezed out and ran down his cheek. He was beginning to feel pathetic and sorry for himself, not for anyone else. "I'm not as selfish as you, because I'm always ill, and I'm sure there is a lump coming on my back," he said, "and I'm going to die besides."
"You're not," contradicted Mary unsympathetically.
He opened his eyes quite wide with indignation. He had never heard such a thing said before. He was at once furious and slightly pleased, if a person could be both at the same time.
"I'm not," he cried. "I am. You know I am. Everybody says so."
"I don't believe it," said Mary sourly. "You just say that to make people sorry. I believe you're proud of it. I don't believe it. If you were a nice boy, it might be true, but you're too nasty." In spite of his invalid back, Colin sat up in bed in quite a healthy rage. "Get out of the room," he shouted, and he caught hold of his pillow and threw it at her. He was not strong enough to throw it far, and it only fell at her feet, but Mary's face looked as pinched as a nutcracker.
"I'm going," she said, "and I won't come back."
She walked to the door, and when she reached it, she turned round and spoke again.
"I was going to tell you all sorts of nice things," she said. "Dickon brought his fox and his rook, and I was going to tell you all about them. Now I won't tell you a single thing."
She marched out of the door and closed it behind her,
And there, to her great astonishment, she found the trained nurse standing as if she had been listening, and more amazing still, she was laughing. She was a big, handsome young woman who ought not to have been a trained nurse at all, as she could not bear invalids, and she was always making excuses to leave Colin to Martha or anyone else who would take her place. Mary had never liked her, and she simply stood and gazed up at her as she stood giggling into her handkerchief.
"What are you laughing at?"
she asked her.
"At you two young ones," said the nurse. "It's the best thing that could happen to the sickly, pampered thing as to have someone to stand up to him that's as spoiled as himself."
And she laughed into her handkerchief again.
"If he'd had a young vixen of a sister to fight with, it would have been the saving of him."
"Is he going to die?"
"I don't know, and I don't care," said the nurse. "Hysterics and temper are half what ails him."
"What are hysterics?" asked Mary.
"You'll find out if you work him into a tantrum after this. But at any rate, you've given him something to have hysterics about, and I'm glad of it."
Mary went back to her room, not feeling at all as she had felt when she had come in from the garden. She was cross and disappointed, but not at all sorry for Colin. She had looked forward to telling him a great many things, and she had meant to try to make up her mind whether it would be safe to trust him with the great secret. She had been beginning to think it would be, but now she had changed her mind entirely. She would never tell him, and he could stay in his room and never get any fresh air and die if he liked. It would serve him right. She felt so sour and unrelenting that for a few minutes she almost forgot about Dickon and the green veil creeping over the world and the soft wind blowing down from the moor. Martha was waiting for her, and the trouble in her face had been temporarily replaced by interest and curiosity. There was a wooden box on the table, and its cover had been removed and revealed that it was full of neat packages.
"Mr. Craven sent it to you," said Martha. "It looks as if it had picture books in it."
Mary remembered what he had asked her the day she had gone to his room. "Do you want anything? Dolls? Toys? Books?" She opened the package, wondering if he had sent a doll, and also wondering what she should do with it if he had. But he had not sent one. There were several beautiful books such as Colin had, and two of them were about gardens and were full of pictures. There were two or three games, and there was a beautiful little writing case with a gold monogram on it and a gold pen and inkstand. Everything was so nice that her pleasure began to crowd her anger out of her mind. She had not expected him to remember her at all, and her hard little heart grew quite warm.
"I can write better than I can print," she said, "and the first thing I shall write with that pen will be a letter to tell him I am much obliged."
If she had been friends with Colin, she would have run to show him her presence at once, and they would have looked at the pictures and read some of the gardening books, and perhaps tried playing the games, and he would have enjoyed himself so much he would never once have thought he was going to die, or have put his hand on his spine to see if there was a lump coming. He had a way of doing that which she could not bear. It gave her an uncomfortable, frightened feeling, because he always looked so frightened himself. He said that if he felt even quite a little lump some day, he should know his hunch had begun to grow. Something he had heard Mrs. Medlock whispering to the nurse had given him the idea, and he had thought over it in secret until it was quite firmly fixed in his mind. Mrs. Medlock had said his father's back had begun to show its crookedness in that way when he was a child. He had never told anyone but Mary that most of his tantrums, as they called them, grew out of his hysterical hidden fear. Mary had been sorry for him when he had told her. "He always began to think about it when he was cross or tired," she said to herself. "And he has been cross today. Perhaps he has been thinking about it all afternoon." She stood still, looking down at the carpet and thinking. "I said I would never go back again," she hesitated, knitting her brows. "But perhaps, just perhaps, I will go and see, if he wants me, in the morning. Perhaps he'll try to throw his pillow at me again, but I think I'll go."
Chapter 17. A Tantrum.
She had got up very early in the morning and had worked hard in the garden, and she was tired and sleepy, so as soon as Martha had brought her supper and she had eaten it, she was glad to go to bed. As she laid her head on the pillow, she murmured to herself, "I'll go out before breakfast and work with Dickon, and then afterward, I believe, I'll go to see him." She thought it was the middle of the night when she was wakened by such dreadful sounds that she jumped out of bed in an instant. What was it? What was it? The next minute she felt quite sure she knew. Doors were opened and shut, and there were hurrying feet in the corridors, and someone was crying and screaming at the same time, screaming and crying in a horrible way. "It's Colin," she said. "He's having one of those tantrums the nurse called hysterics. How awful it sounds!" As she listened to the sobbing screams, she did not wonder that people were so frightened that they gave him his own way in everything rather than hear them. She put her hands over her ears and felt sick and shivering. "I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do," she kept saying. "I can't bear it." Once she wondered if he would stop if she dared go to him, and then she remembered how he had driven her out of the room and thought that perhaps the sight of her might make him worse. Even when she pressed her hands more tightly over her ears, she could not keep the awful sounds out. She hated them so, and was so terrified by them, that suddenly they began to make her angry, and she felt as if she should like to fly into a tantrum herself and frighten him as he was frightening her. She was not used to anyone's tempers but her own. She took her hands from her ears and sprang up and stamped her feet. "He ought to be stopped! Somebody ought to make him stop! Somebody ought to beat him!" she cried out. Just then she heard feet almost running down the corridor, and her door opened and the nurse came in. She was not laughing now by any means. She even looked rather pale. "He's worked himself into hysterics," she said in a great hurry. "He'll do himself harm. No one can do anything with him. You come and try like a good child. He likes you." "He turned me out of the room this morning," said Mary, stamping her foot with excitement. The stamp rather pleased the nurse. The truth was that she had been afraid she might find Mary crying and hiding her head under the bedclothes. "That's right," she said. "You're in the right humour. You go and scold him. Give him something new to think of. Do go, child, as quick as ever you can." It was not until afterward that Mary realised that the thing had been funny as well as dreadful. That it was funny that all the grown-up people were so frightened that they came to a little girl, just because they guessed she was almost as bad as Colin herself. She flew along the corridor, and the nearer she got to the screams, the higher her temper mounted. She felt quite wicked by the time she reached the door. She slapped it open with her hand and ran across the room to the four-posted bed. "You stop!" she almost shouted. "You stop! I hate you! Everybody hates you! I wish everybody would run out of the house and let you scream yourself to death! You will scream yourself to death in a minute, and I wish you would!" A nice, sympathetic child could neither have thought nor said such things. But it just happened that the shock of hearing them was the best possible thing for this hysterical boy, whom no one had ever dared to restrain or contradict. He had been lying on his face, beating his pillow with his hands, and he actually almost jumped around, he turned so quickly at the sound of the furious little voice. His face looked dreadful, white and red and swollen, and he was gasping and choking, but savage little Mary did not care an atom. "If you scream another scream," she said, "I'll scream too, and I can scream louder than you can, and I'll frighten you, I'll frighten you!" He actually had stopped screaming because she had startled him so. The scream which had been coming almost choked him. The tears were streaming down his face and he shook all over.
"I can't stop," he gasped and sobbed. "I can't, I can't."
"You can," shouted Mary. "Half that ails you is hysterics and temper. Just hysterics, hysterics, hysterics." And she stamped each time she said it.
"I felt the lump. I felt it," choked out Colin. "I knew I should. I shall have a hunch on my back and then I shall die."
And he began to writhe again and turned on his face and sobbed and wailed, but he didn't scream.
You didn't feel a lump, contradicted Mary fiercely. If you did, it was only a hysterical lump. Hysterics makes lumps. There's nothing the matter with your horrid back. Nothing but hysterics. Turn over and let me look at it. She liked the word hysterics and felt somehow as if it had an effect on him. He was probably like herself and had never heard it before. Nurse, she commanded, come here and show me his back this minute. The nurse, Mrs. Medlock, and Martha had been standing huddled together near the door, staring at her, their mouths half open. All three had gasped with fright more than once. The nurse came forward as if she were half afraid. Colin was heaving with great, breathless sobs.
Perhaps he won't let me, she hesitated in a low voice.
Colin heard her, however, and he gasped out between two sobs,
Show her! She'll see then!
It was a poor, thin back to look at when it was bared. Every rib could be counted and every joint of the spine, though Mistress Mary did not count them as she bent over and examined them with a solemn, savage little face. She looked so sour and old-fashioned that the nurse turned her head aside to hide the twitching of her mouth. There was just a minute's silence, for even Colin tried to hold his breath, while Mary looked up and down his spine, and down and up, as intently as if she had been the great doctor from London. "There's not a single lump there," she said at last. "There's not a lump as big as a pin, except backbone lumps, and you can only feel them because you're thin." I've got backbone lumps myself, and they used to stick out as much as yours do until I began to get fatter, and I am not fat enough yet to hide them. There's not a lump as big as a pin. If you ever say there is again, I shall laugh. No one but Colin himself knew what effect those crossly spoken childish words had on him. If he had ever had anyone to talk to about his secret terrors, if he had ever dared to let himself ask questions, if he had had childish companions and had not lain on his back in the huge closed house, breathing an atmosphere heavy with the fears of people who were most of them ignorant and tired of him, he would have found out that most of his fright and illness was created by himself. But he had lain and thought of himself and his aches and weariness for hours and days and months and years. And now that an angry, unsympathetic little girl insisted obstinately that he was not as ill as he thought he was, he actually felt as if she might be speaking the truth.
"I didn't know," ventured the nurse, "that he thought he had a lump on his spine. His back is weak because he won't try to sit up. I could have told him there was no lump there."
Colin gulped and turned his face a little to look at her.
"Could you?" he said pathetically.
"Yes, sir."
"There,"
said Mary, and she gulped too. Colin turned on his face again, and but for his long-drawn broken breaths, which were the dying down of his storm of sobbing, he lay still for a minute, though great tears streamed down his face and wet the pillow. Actually, the tears meant that a curious great relief had come to him. Presently he turned and looked at the nurse again, and strangely enough, he was not like a rajah at all as he spoke to her.
"Do you think I could live to grow up?" he said.
The nurse was neither clever nor soft-hearted, but she could repeat some of the London doctor's words. "You probably will if you will do what you are told to do and not give way to your temper and stay out a great deal in the fresh air." Colin's tantrum had passed, and he was weak and worn out with crying, and this perhaps made him feel gentle. He put out his hand a little toward Mary, and I'm glad to say that, her own tantrum having passed, she was softened too, and met him halfway with her hand, so that it was a sort of making up.
I'll go out with you, Mary, he said. I shan't hate fresh air if we can find...
He remembered just in time to stop himself from saying, "If we can find the secret garden," and he ended,
"I shall like to go out with you if Dickon will come and push my chair. I do so want to see Dickon and the fox and the crow."
The nurse remade the tumbled bed and shook and straightened the pillows.
Then she made Colin a cup of beef tea and gave a cup to Mary, who really was very glad to get it after her excitement. Mrs. Medlock and Martha gladly slipped away, and after everything was neat and calm and in order, the nurse looked as if she would very gladly slip away also. She was a healthy young woman who resented being robbed of her sleep, and she yawned quite openly as she looked at Mary, who had pushed her big footstool close to the four-posted bed and was holding Colin's hand.
"You must go back and get your sleep out," she said. "He'll drop off after a while, if he's not too upset. Then I'll lie down myself in the next room."
"Would you like me to sing you that song I learned from my Ayah?" Mary whispered to Colin.
His hand pulled hers gently, and he turned his tired eyes on her appealingly.
"Oh, yes," he answered. "It's such a soft song. I shall go to sleep in a minute."
"I will put him to sleep," Mary said to the yawning nurse. "You can go if you like."
"Well," said the nurse with an attempt at reluctance, "if he doesn't go to sleep in half an hour, you must call me."
"Very well," answered Mary.
The nurse was out of the room in a minute, and as soon as she was gone, Colin pulled Mary's hand again.
"I almost told," he said, "but I stopped myself in time. I won't talk and I'll go to sleep, but you said you had a whole lot of nice things to tell me. Do you think you have found out anything at all about the way into the secret garden?"
Mary looked at his poor little tired face and swollen eyes, and her heart relented.
"Yes," she answered. "I think I have. And if you will go to sleep, I will tell you tomorrow."
His hand quite trembled.
"Oh, Mary," he said. "Oh, Mary, if I could get into it, I think I should live to grow up. Do you suppose that instead of singing the Ayah song, you could just tell me softly, as you did that first day, what you imagine it looks like inside? I'm sure it will make me go to sleep."
"Yes," answered Mary. "Shut your eyes."
He closed his eyes and lay quite still, and she held his hand and began to speak very slowly and in a very low voice.
"I think it has been left alone so long that it has grown all into a lovely tangle. I think the roses have climbed and climbed and climbed until they hang from the branches and walls and creep over the ground, almost like a strange grey mist. Some of them have died, but many are alive, and when the summer comes, there will be curtains and fountains of roses. I think the ground is full of daffodils and snowdrops and lilies and iris working their way out of the dark. Now the spring has begun. Perhaps...
The soft drone of her voice was making him stiller and stiller, and she saw it and went on.
"Perhaps they are coming up through the grass. Perhaps there are clusters of purple crocuses and gold ones, even now. Perhaps the leaves are beginning to break out and uncurl, and perhaps the grey is changing and a green gauze veil is creeping and creeping over everything. And the birds are coming to look at it, because it is so safe and still. And perhaps,
very softly and slowly indeed,
the robin has found a mate and is building a nest."
And Colin was asleep. Chapter 18. "Thou munnot waste no time." Of course, Mary did not waken early the next morning. She slept late because she was tired, and when Martha brought her breakfast, she told her that though Colin was quite quiet, he was ill and feverish, as he always was after he had worn himself out with a fit of crying. Mary ate her breakfast slowly as she listened.
"He says he wishes thou would please go and see him as soon as thou can," Martha said. "It's queer what a fancy he's took to thee.
Thou did give it to him last night for sure, didn't thou? Nobody else would have dared to do it."
"Eh, poor lad, he's been spoiled till salt won't save him.
Mother says as the two worst things as can happen to a child is never to have his own way, or always to have it. She doesn't know which is the worst. That was in a fine temper thyself, too. But he says to me when I went into his room, please ask Miss Mary if she'll please come and talk to me. Think of him saying please.